There had been relatively little conversation following this revelation. Just a glance at Jem, a sharp question about whether he went to Sunday school, an intake of breath at the answer, and a gimlet-eyed stare at Roger before they took their leave. "Do you want me to convert?" Bree had demanded in the due course of the argument, and it had been a demand, not an offer. He'd wanted suddenly and fiercely to ask her to do just that, only to see if she would, for love of him. But religious conscience would never let him do such a thing, still less his conscience as her lover, her husband. Huntley Street turned suddenly into Bank Street, and the foot traffic of the shopping precinct disappeared. He passed the small memorial garden put up to commemorate the service of nurses during World War II and thought, as he always did, of Claire, though this time with less than the usual admiration he had for her.
"And what would you say?" he thought.
He knew damn well what she'd say, or at least whose side she'd be on, in this. She hadn't hung about being a full-time mum, had she? She'd gone to medical school when Bree was 7. And Bree's dad, Frank Randall, had taken up the slack whether he wanted to or not. He slowed his step briefly, realizing. No wonder then if Bree was thinking. He passed the Free North Church and half-smiled at it, thinking of Mrs. Ogilvy and Mrs. McNeil. They'd be back, he knew, if he didn't do something about it. He knew their brand of determined kindliness. Dear God, if they heard that Bree had gone to work and, to their way of thinking, abandoned him with 2 small children, they'd be running shepherd's pies and hot stovies out to him in relays. That mightn't be such a bad thing, he thought, meditatively licking his lips, save that they'd stay to poke their noses into the workings of his household, and letting them into Brianna's kitchen would not be merely playing with dynamite but deliberately throwing a bottle of nitroglycerin into the midst of his marriage. Catholics don't believe in divorce, Bree had informed him once. We do believe in murder. There's always confession, after all. On the far shore was the only Anglican church in Inverness, St. Andrew's. One Catholic church, one Anglican church, and no fewer than 6 Presbyterian churches, all standing 4 square by the river in the space of less than a quarter mile. Tell you all you needed to know, he thought, about the basic character of Inverness. And he had told Bree, though without, he admitted, mentioning his own crisis of faith. She hadn't asked. He'd give her that. He'd come within a hair of ordination in North Carolina, and in the traumatic aftermath of that interruption, with Mandy's birth, the disintegration of the Ridges community, the decision to risk the passage through the stones, no one had mentioned it. Likewise, when they'd come back, the immediate demands of taking care of Mandy's heart and then assembling some kind of life, the question of his ministry had been ignored. He thought Brianna hadn't mentioned it because she wasn't sure how he meant to handle it and didn't want to seem to push him in either direction. If her being a Catholic made his being a Presbyterian minister in Inverness more complicated, he couldn't ignore the fact that his being a minister would cause major complications in her life. And she'd know that. The upshot was that neither of them had talked about it when working out the details of their return. They'd worked out the practicalities as best they could. He couldn't go back to Oxford, not without a truly elaborate cover story.
You can't just drop in and out of academia, he'd explained to Bree and to Joe Abernathy, the doctor who had been Claire's long-time friend before her own departure to the past. You can go on a sabbatical, too, or even an extended leave. But you have to have a stated purpose and something to show for your absence when you come back, in terms of published research. You could write a killer book about the regulation, though, Joe Abernathy had observed, or the run-up to the revolution in the South.
I could, he admitted, but not a respectable, scholarly one.
He'd smiled wryly, feeling the slight itch in the joints of his fingers. He could write a book,
one that no one else could write, but not as a historian.
No sources,
he'd explained, with a nod at the shelves in Joe's study where they were holding the first of several councils of war.
If I wrote a book as a historian, I'd need to provide sources for all the information, and for most of the unique situations I could describe. I'm sure nothing was ever recorded.
Eyewitness testimony of author wouldn't go over well with a university press, I assure you. I'd have to do it as a novel.
That idea actually held some small appeal, but wouldn't impress the colleges of Oxford.
Scotland, though.
People didn't appear in Inverness or anywhere else in the Highlands unremarked. But Roger wasn't an incomer. He'd grown up in the manse in Inverness, and there were still a good many people who had known him as an adult. And with an American wife and children to explain his absence.
See, folk there don't really care what it is you were doing when you were away, he explained. They only care about what you do when you're there.
He'd reached the islands of the Ness by now, a small quiet park set on small islets that lay only a few feet off the river's bank. It had packed dirt paths, big trees, and little traffic at this time of day. He wandered the paths, trying to empty his mind, let it be filled only with the sound of the rushing water, the quietness of the overcast sky. He reached the end of the island and stood for a time, half seeing the debris left in the branches of the bushes that edged the water, wadges of dead leaves, birds' feathers, fish bones, the odd cigarette packet, deposited by the passage of high water. He had, of course, been thinking of himself, what he'd be doing, what folk would think about him. Why had it never occurred to him to wonder what Brianna intended doing if they went to Scotland?
Well, that was obvious, if stupid in retrospect.
On the ridge, Bree had done, well, a bit more than the usual woman there did. True, one couldn't overlook the buffalo hunting, turkey shooting, goddess huntress, pirate killing side of her, but also what the usual woman did. Mind her family, feed, clothe, comfort, or occasionally smack them. And with Mandy sick, and Brianna grieving the loss of her parents, the question of working at anything had been irrelevant. Nothing could have separated her from her daughter. But Mandy was well now, hair-raisingly healthy, as the trail of destruction that followed her testified. The painstaking details of re-establishing their identities in the 20th century had been accomplished. The purchase of Lallybroch, made from the bank that owned it, the physical removal to Scotland accomplished, Jem settled, more or less, into the village school nearby, and a nice girl from the same village engaged to come clear up and help look after Mandy. And now Brianna was going to work. Roger was going to hell, metaphorically, if not literally. Brianna couldn't say she hadn't been warned. It was a man's world she was walking into. A rough job it had been, a tough undertaking, the toughest, digging the tunnels that carried the miles of cable from the turbines of the hydroelectric plants. Tunnel tigers, they'd called the men who dug them, many of them Polish and Irish immigrants who'd come for a job in the 1950s. She'd read about them, seen pictures of them, grimy-faced and white-eyed as coal miners, in the Hydroelectric Authority office. The walls were covered with them, documentation of Scotland's proudest modern achievement. What had been Scotland's proudest ancient achievement, she wondered? The kilt? She suppressed a laugh at the thought, but evidently it made her look pleasant, because Mr. Campbell, the personnel manager, had smiled kindly at her.
You're in luck, lass. We've an opening at Pitlochry, starting in a month, he'd said.
That's wonderful. She had a folder in her lap containing her credentials. He didn't ask to see it, which rather surprised her, but she set it on the desk before him, flipping it open. Here are my... He was staring at the curriculum vitae on top, his mouth hanging open far enough for her to see the steel fillings in his back teeth. He shut his mouth, glanced up at her in astonishment, then looked back at the folder, slowly lifting the CV as though afraid there might be something even more shocking underneath.
"I think I have all the qualifications," she said, restraining the nervous urge to clench her fingers in the fabric of her skirt. "To be a plant inspector, I mean." She knew damned well she did. She had the qualifications to build a freaking hydroelectric station, let alone inspect one.
"Inspector," he said faintly.
Then he coughed and flushed a bit. "Heavy smoker." She could smell the fug of tobacco that clung to his clothes.
"I'm afraid there's been a bit of a misunderstanding, my dear," he said. "It's a secretary we're needing at Pitlochry."
"Perhaps you do," she said, giving in to the cloth-clenching urge. "But the advertisement I replied to was for plant inspector, and that's the position I'm applying for."
"But, my dear,"
he was shaking his head, clearly appalled,
"you're a woman."
"I am," she said, "and any of 100 men who'd known her father would have picked up the ring of steel in her voice and given in on the spot. Mr. Campbell, unfortunately, hadn't known Jamie Fraser, but was about to be enlightened. Would you care to explain to me exactly which aspects of plant inspection require a penis?" His eyes bulged, and he turned the shade of a turkey's wattles in courting season.
That is...
With evident effort, he mastered himself enough to speak courteously, though the shock was still plain on his blunt features.
"Mrs. Mackenzie, I'm not unfamiliar with the notion of women's liberation, I've daughters of my own, and none of them would have said something like that to me," his raised brow said. "It's not that I think you'd be incompetent."
He glanced at the open folder, raised both brows briefly, then shut it firmly.
"It's the work environment. It wouldn't be suitable for a woman."
"Why not?" He was recovering his aplomb by now.
"The conditions are often physically rough, and to be honest, Mrs. Mackenzie, so are the men you would encounter. The company cannot in good conscience, or as a matter of good business, risk your safety."
"You employ men who would be likely to assault a woman?"
"No, we..."
"You have plants that are physically dangerous? Then you do need an inspector, don't you?"
"The legalities..."
"I'm well up on the regulations pertaining to hydroelectric plants," she said firmly. And reaching into her bag, produced the printed booklet of regulations, obviously well thumbed, supplied by the Highlands and Islands Development Board. "I can spot problems, and I can tell you how to rectify them promptly and as economically as possible." Mr. Campbell was looking deeply unhappy. "And I hear that you haven't had many applicants for this position," she finished.
"None, to be exact."
"The men."
"Men," she said, and allowed the smallest edge of amusement to tinge the word. "I've worked with men before. I get on with them well." She looked at him, not saying anything.
"I know what it's like to kill a man," she thought. "I know just how easy it is. And you don't."
She was not aware of having changed expression, but Campbell lost a bit of his high colour and looked away. She wondered for a split second whether Roger would look away if he saw that knowledge in her eyes. But this was no time to think of things like that.
"Why don't you show me one of the work sites?" she said gently. "Then we'll talk some more."
In the 18th century, St. Stephen's had been used as a temporary prison for captured Jacobites. Two of them had been executed in the graveyard, by some accounts. It wasn't the worst thing to have as your last sight of earth, he supposed. The wide river and the vast sky, both flowing to the sea. They carried an abiding sense of peace. Wind and cloud and water did, despite their constant movement.
"If ever you find yourself in the midst of paradox, you can be sure you stand on the edge of truth,"
his adoptive father had told him once.
"You may not know what it is, mind," he'd added with a smile, "but it's there."
The rector at St. Stephen's, Dr. Weatherspoon, had had a few aphorisms to share, too.
When God closes a door, he opens a window. Yeah, the problem was that this particular window opened off the 10th story, and he wasn't so sure God supplied parachutes.
Do you?
He asked, looking up at the drifting sky over Inverness.
Beg pardon?
Said the startled sexton, popping up from the gravestone behind which he'd been working.
Sorry.
Roger flapped a hand, embarrassed.
Just talking to myself.
The elderly man nodded understandingly.
Aye, aye. Nae bother, then. It's when you start getting answers you should worry.
Chuckling hoarsely, he descended back out of sight. Roger made his way down from the high graveyard to street level, walking slowly back to the car park. Well, he'd taken the first step, well past the time he should have done. Bree was right, to a degree. He had been a coward, but he had done it. The difficulty wasn't resolved as yet, but it had been a great comfort, only being able to lay it out for someone who understood and sympathised.
I'll pray for you,
Dr. Weatherspoon had said, shaking his hand in parting. That was a comfort, too. He started up the dank concrete steps of the car park, fumbling in his pocket for the keys. Couldn't say he was entirely at peace with himself just yet, but he felt a lot more peaceable toward Bree. Now he could go home and tell her.
No, damn it, he couldn't, not yet. He had to check.
He didn't have to check. He knew he was right. But he had to have it in his hands, had to be able to show Bree. Turning abruptly on his heel, he strode past a puzzled car park attendant coming up behind him, took the stairs two at a time, and walked up Huntley Street as though he trod on red-hot coals. He stopped briefly at the Fox, digging in his pocket for coins, and rang through from the call box to Lallybroch. Annie answered the phone with her customary rudeness, saying, "Yes," with such abruptness that it emerged as little more than an interrogatory hiss. He didn't bother rebuking her phone manners.
"It's Roger. Tell the missus I'm going down to Oxford to look something up. I'll spend the night."
"Mm-hmm," she said, and hung up. She wanted to hit Roger over the head with a blunt object, something like a champagne bottle, maybe. "He went where?" she asked, though she'd heard Annie MacDonald clearly. Annie lifted both narrow shoulders to the level of her ears, indicating that she understood the rhetorical nature of the question.
"To Oxford," she said. "To England."
The tone of her voice underlined the sheer outrageousness of Roger's action. He hadn't simply gone to look up something in an old book, which would have been strange enough, though to be sure himself was a scholar and they'd do anything, but had abandoned his wife and children without notice and hide away to a foreign country.
"Himself did say as he'd come home tomorrow," Annie added with great dubiousness.
She picked up the bottle of champagne in its carrier bag gingerly, as though it might explode.
"Ought I to put this to the ice, do you think?"
"To the... Oh, no, don't put it in the freezer, just in the fridge."
"Thank you, Annie." Annie disappeared into the kitchen, and Brianna stood in the draughty hall for a moment, trying to get her feelings firmly under control before going to find Jem and Mandy. Kids being kids, they had ultra-sensitive radar concerning their parents. They already knew something was the matter between Roger and her. Having their father suddenly disappear was not calculated to give them a feeling of cosy security. Had he even said goodbye to them? Assured them he'd be back? No, of course not. "Bloody selfish, self-centred," she muttered. Unable to find a satisfying noun with which to complete this, she said, "Rat faint bastard," and then snorted with reluctant laughter. Not merely at the silliness of the insult, but with a wry acknowledgement that she'd got what she wanted. Both ways. Granted, he couldn't have stopped her going for the job, and once he got past the dislocations involved, she thought he'd be all right with it. "Men hate things to change," her mother had once casually told her. Unless it's their idea, of course. But you can make them think it is their idea sometimes. Maybe she should have been less direct about it, tried to get Roger to feel that at least he had something to say about her going to work, even if not to think it was his idea. That would have been pushing it. She'd been in no mood to be devious, though, or even diplomatic. As for what she'd done to him, well, she'd put up with his immobility for as long as she could, and then she'd pushed him off a cliff, deliberately. And I don't feel the least bit guilty about it, she said to the coat rack. She hung up her coat slowly, taking a little extra time to check the pockets for used tissues and crumpled receipts. So, had he gone off out of pique to get back at her for going back to work, or out of anger at her having called him a coward? He hadn't liked that one bit. His eyes had gone dark and he'd nearly lost his voice. Strong emotion choked him, quite literally freezing his larynx. She'd done it on purpose, though. She knew where Roger's soft spots were, just as he knew hers. Her lips tightened at that, just as her fingers closed on something hard in the inner pocket of her jacket. A weathered shell, turreted and smooth, worn white by sun and water. Roger had picked it up on the shingle by Loch Ness and handed it to her.
"To live in," he'd said, smiling,
but given away by the gruffness of his damaged voice.
"When you need a hiding place."
She closed her fingers gently over the shell and sighed. Roger wasn't petty, ever. He wouldn't go off to Oxford. A reluctant bubble of amusement floated up at the thought of Annie's shocked description.
To England? Just to worry her?
So he'd gone for some specific reason, doubtless something jarred loose by their fight, and that worried her a bit. He'd been wrestling with things since they came back.
Well, so had she, of course.
Mandy's illness, decisions about where to live, all the petty details of relocating a family in both space and time. They'd done all that together. But there were things he wrestled with alone. She'd grown up an only child, just as he had. She knew how it was, how you lived in your own head a lot. But damn him! Whatever he was living with in his head was eating him up before her eyes. And if he wouldn't tell her what it was either something he considered too private to share, which bugged her, but she could live with it, or it was something he thought too disturbing or too dangerous to share, and she wasn't bloody having that. Her fingers had clenched round the shell, and she deliberately loosened them, trying to calm down. She could hear the kids upstairs, in Jem's room. He was reading something to Mandy, the gingerbread man, she thought. She couldn't hear the words, but could tell by the rhythm, counterpointed by Mandy's excited shouts of, "One! One!" No point in interrupting them. Time enough later to tell them Daddy'd be away overnight. Maybe they wouldn't be bothered, if she was matter-of-fact about it. He'd never left them since they'd come back, but when they lived on the ridge, he was often gone with Jamie or Ian hunting. Mandy wouldn't remember that, but Jem. She'd meant to go into her study, but found herself drifting across the hall through the open door to Roger's. It was the old speak-a-word room of the house, the room where her uncle Ian had run the affairs of the estate for years, her father for a short time before that, and her grandfather before him. And now it was Roger's. He'd asked if she wanted the room, but she'd said no. She liked the little sitting room across the hall with its sunny window and the shadows of the ancient yellow rose that flagged that side of the house with its colour and scent. Aside from that, though, she just felt that this room was a man's place, with its clean, scuffed wooden floor and comfortably battered shelves. Roger had managed to find one of the old farm ledgers from 1776. It sat on an upper shelf, its worn cloth binding sheltering the patient, careful minutiae of life on a Highland farm. 1/4 pound of silver fir seed, a he-goat for breeding, 6 rabbits, 30 weight of seed potatoes. Had her uncle written it?
She didn't know, had never seen a sample of his writing. She wondered, with an odd little quiver of the insides, if her parents had made it back to Scotland.
Back here. Had seen Ian and Jenny again. If her father had sat, would sit, here, in this room, at home once more, talking over the matters of Lallybroch with Ian. And her mother? From the little Claire had said about it, she hadn't parted from Jenny on the best of terms, and Brianna knew her mother felt sad about that. Once they had been close friends. Maybe things could be mended. Maybe they had been mended. She glanced at the wooden box safe on its high shelf beside the ledger, the little cherrywood snake curved in front of it. On impulse, she took the snake down, finding some comfort in the sleek curve of the body and the comical look of its face peering back over its non-existent shoulder. She smiled back at it, involuntarily. "Thanks, Uncle Willie," she said softly, out loud, and felt an extraordinary shiver run through her. Not fear or cold, a kind of delight, but a quiet kind. Recognition. She'd seen that snake so often on the ridge, and now here, where it had first been made, that she never thought of its maker, her father's older brother, dead at the age of 11. But he was here too, in the work of his hands, in the rooms that had known him. When she'd visited Lallybroch before, in the 18th century, there had been a painting of him on the upstairs landing, a small, sturdy, red-haired boy, standing with a hand on the shoulder of his baby brother, blue-eyed and serious. Where is that now? She wondered. And the other paintings done by her grandmother. There was the one self-portrait which had made it somehow to the National Portrait Gallery. She must be sure to take the kids down to London to see it when they were a little older. But the others? There had been one of a very young Jenny Murray feeding a tame pheasant who had her Uncle Ian's soft brown eyes. And she smiled at the memory. It had been the right thing, coming here, bringing the kids home. It didn't matter if it took a little doing for her and Roger to find their places. Though maybe she shouldn't speak for Roger, she thought with a grimace. She looked up at the box again. She wished her parents were here, either of them, so she could tell them about Roger, ask their opinion. Not that she wanted advice so much. What she wanted, if she was honest, she thought, was a reassurance that she'd done the right thing. With a heightened flush in her cheeks, she reached up with both hands and brought down the box, feeling guilty for not waiting to share the next letter with Roger. But she wanted her mother just now. She took the first letter on top that bore her mother's writing on the outside. Offices of Longyon, New Bern, North Carolina, April the 12th, 1777. Dear Bree, and Roger and Jem and Mandy, of course. We've made it to New Bern without major incident. Yes, I hear you thinking, major? And it is true that we were held up by a pair of would-be bandits on the road south of Boone. Given that they were probably 9 and 11 respectively, and armed solely with an ancient wheel-lock musket that would have blown them both to bits had they been able to fire it, though, we weren't in any marked danger. Rollo leapt out of the wagon and knocked one of them flat, whereupon his brother dropped the gun and legged it. Your cousin Ian ran him down, though, hauling him back by the scruff of the neck. It took your father some little time to get anything sensible out of them, but a little food worked wonders. They said their names are Herman and, no, really, Vermin. Their parents died during the winter. Their father went hunting and didn't come back. The mother died giving birth, and the baby died a day later, as the two boys had no way to feed it. They know of no people on their father's side, but they said their mother's family name was Kuykendall. Luckily, your father knows a Kuykendall family near Bailey Camp. And so Ian took the little vagabonds off to find the Kuykendalls and see if they could be settled. If not, I suppose he'll bring them along to New Bern, and we'll try to apprentice them somewhere. Or perhaps take them with us to Wilmington and find them a berth as cabin boys. Fergus and Marsali and the children all seem to be doing very well, both physically, bar a family tendency to enlarged adenoids and the biggest wart I've ever seen on Germaine's left elbow, and financially. Aside from the Wilmington Gazette, Lognon is the only regular newspaper in the colony, and thus Fergus gets a great deal of business. Add in the printing and sale of books and pamphlets, and he's doing very well indeed. The family now owns 2 milch goats, a flock of chickens, a pig, and 3 mules, counting Clarence, whom we are bequeathing to them on our way to Scotland. Conditions and uncertainties being what they are, meaning, Brianna thought, that you don't know who might read this letter or when, I'd better not be specific about what he's printing, besides newspapers. Lognon itself is carefully even-handed, printing rabid denunciations by both loyalists and those less loyal, and publishing satirical poetry by our good friend Anonymous, lampooning both sides of the present political conflict. I've seldom seen Fergus so happy. War agrees with some men, and Fergus, rather oddly, is one of them. Your cousin Ian is another, though in his case I think perhaps it keeps him from thinking too much. I do wonder what his mother will make of him. But knowing her as I do, my guess is that after the first shock has passed, she'll begin the work of finding him a wife. Jenny is a very perceptive woman, all things said, and just as stubborn as your father. I do hope he remembers that. Speaking of your father, he's out and about a good deal with Fergus, doing bits of business, unspecified, which means he's probably doing something that would turn my hair white, or whiter, to know about, and inquiring among the merchants for a possible ship, though I think our chances of finding one will be better in Wilmington, where we'll go as soon as Ian joins us. Meanwhile, I've set up my shingle, literally. It's tacked to the front of Fergus's print shop and says, teeth pulled, rashes, phlegm, and the ague cured, this being Masali's work. She wanted to add a line about the pox, but both Fergus and I dissuaded her. He, from a fear that it would lower the tone of his establishment. Self, from a certain morbid attachment to truth in advertising, as there is, in fact, nothing I can presently do about any condition they call the pox. Phlegm. Well, there's always something you can do about phlegm, even if it's nothing more than a cup of hot tea. These days, that's hot water over sassafras root, catnip, or lemon balm, with a dram in it. I called on Dr. Fentiman in Cross Creek on our way, and was able to buy several necessary instruments and a few medicines from him to refurbish my kit. This, at the cost of a bottle of whiskey, and of being forced to admire the latest addition to his ghastly collection of pickled curiosities. No, you don't want to know. You really don't. A good thing he can't see Germaine's wart, or he'd been down to New Bern in a flash, sneaking round the print shop with an amputation saw. I still lack a pair of good surgical scissors, but Fergus knows a silversmith called Stephen Morrie in Wilmington, who, he says, could make a pair to my specifications. For the moment, I occupy myself largely in the pulling of teeth, as the barber who used to do it was drowned last November, having fallen into the harbour while drunk. With all my love, Mama. P.S. Speaking of the Wilmington Gazette, your father has it in mind to call there and see if he can find out just who left that blasted notice about the fire. Though I suppose I oughtn't to complain. If you hadn't found it, you might never have come back. And while there are a lot of things I wish hadn't happened as a result of your coming, I can't ever regret that you know your father, and he you. Chapter 17. We Demons. It wasn't much different than any of the deer trails they'd come across. In fact, it had doubtless begun as one of them. But there was something about this particular trace that said people to Ian, and he'd been so long accustomed to such judgments that he seldom registered them consciously. He didn't now, but gave Clarence's leading rein a twitch, turning his own horse's head aside.
"Why are we stopping?" Herman asked suspiciously. "Ain't nothing here."
"There's someone living up there." Ian jerked his chin toward the wooded slope. "The trail's not wide enough for horses. We'll tie up here and walk."
Herman and Vermin exchanged a wordless glance of deep scepticism, but slid off the mule and trudged after Ian up the trail. He was beginning to have his doubts. No one he'd spoken to in the last week knew of any Kaikondals in the area, and he couldn't take too much more time about the matter. He might have to bring the wee savages down to New Bern with him, after all, and he had no notion how they'd take to the suggestion. He had no notion how they took much of anything, come to that. They were not so much shy as secretive, whispering together behind him as they rode, then shutting up like clams the minute he looked at them, regarding him with carefully bland faces behind which he plainly saw any amount of reckoning going on. What the devil were they plotting? If they meant to run from him, he thought that he might not make any monstrous great effort to chase them down. If, on the other hand, they meant to steal Clarence and the horse while he slept, that was another matter. The cabin was there, a curl of smoke coming from its chimney. Herman turned a look of surprise on him, and he smiled at the boy.
"Told you,"
he said, and hallooed. The door creaked open, and the barrel of a musket poked out of it. This was not an uncommon response to strangers in the far back country, and Ian was not put off by it. He raised his voice and stated his business, pushing Herman and Vermin in front of him as evidence of his bona fides. The gun wasn't withdrawn, but lifted in a significant manner. Obeying instinct, Ian flung himself flat, yanking the boys down with him as the shot roared overhead. A woman's voice yelled something strident in a foreign tongue. He didn't understand the words, but took the meaning clearly, and pulling the little boys to their feet, ushered them hastily back down the trail.
"Ain't gonna live with her,"
Vermin informed him, focusing a narrow glare of dislike over his shoulder.
"Tell you that for free."
"No, you're not," Ian agreed. "Keep moving, aye?"
For Vermin had stopped dead.
"Got a shit."
"Oh, aye. Well, be quick about it."
He turned away, having discovered early on that the boys had an exaggerated requirement for privacy in such matters. Herman had gone on already. The tangled mess of his dirty blonde hair was just visible some 20 yards down the slope. Ian had suggested that the boys might cut, if not comb, their hair, and maybe wash their faces, as a gesture of civility toward any relations who might be faced with the prospect of taking them in. But this suggestion had been rejected with vehemence. Fortunately, he was not responsible for forcing the wee buggers to wash, and to be fair, he thought washing would make little difference to their smell, given the state of their clothes, which they had plainly been living in for some months. He did make them sleep on the other side of the fire from himself and Rollo at night, in hopes of limiting his exposure to the lice both of them crawled with. Could the notable infestation he sported possibly be where the younger boy's parents had acquired his name, he wondered? Or had they no notion of its meaning, had it only picked it to rhyme with his elder brother's? Clarence's ear-splitting bray pulled him abruptly from his thoughts. He lengthened his stride, berating himself for having left his own gun in its saddle loop. He hadn't wanted to approach the house armed, but a shriek from below sent him dodging off the path into the trees. Another shriek was cut off suddenly, and he scrambled down the slope as quickly as he might without making a racket.
Panther? A bear?
Nay, Clarence would be bellowing like a grampus if it was that. Instead, he was gurgling and wheezing like he did when he spotted someone he knew. Ian stopped dead behind a screen of poplars, his heart cold in his chest. Archbug turned his head, hearing the noise, faint as it was.
"Come out, lad," he called. "I can see you there."
Plainly he did. The ancient eyes were looking straight at him, and Ian came slowly out of the trees. Arch had taken the gun from the horse. It was slung across his shoulder. He had an arm crooked round Herman's throat, and the little boy's face was bright red from the choking. His feet kicked like a dying rabbit's, a few inches off the ground.
"Where's the gold?"
Arch said, without preamble. His white hair was neatly bound up, and he seemed, so far as Ian could see, to have taken no harm from the winter. Must have found folk to bide with.
Where?
He wondered. Brownsville, maybe?
Bloody dangerous if he told the Browns about the gold.
But he thought old Arch was too downy a bird to talk in such company.
"Where you'll never find it," Ian said bluntly.
He was thinking furiously. He'd a knife in his belt, but it was a good deal too far to throw it, and if he missed...
"What do you want with that wain?" he asked, moving a little closer. "He's not to do with you."
"No, but he seems somewhat to do with you."
Herman was making rasping squeaks, and his feet, while still kicking, were slowing.
"No,
he's not to me either,"
Ian said, striving for casualness.
"I'm only helping him to find his people. You plan to cut his throat if I didn't tell you where the gold is?
Go ahead. I'm not telling you."
He didn't see Arch pull the knife, but it was there suddenly in his right hand, held awkwardly because of the missing fingers, but doubtless useful enough.
"All right,"
Arch said calmly, and put the point of the knife under Herman's chin. A scream burst from behind Ian, and Vermin half ran, half fell down the last few feet of the trail. Archbug looked up, startled, and Ian crouched to rush him, but was forestalled by Vermin. The little boy rushed at Archbug and gave him a tremendous kick in the shin, shouting,
"You bad old man! You let her go right now!"
Arch seemed as startled by the speech as by the kick, but didn't let go.
"Her?"
he said, and looked down at the child in his grasp, who promptly turned her head and bit him fiercely in the wrist. Ian, seizing the moment, lunged at him, but was impeded by Vermin, who had now seized Arch by the thigh and was clinging like grim death, trying to punch the old man in the balls with one small clenched fist. With a ferocious grunt, Arch jerked the little girl, if that's what she was, up and flung her staggering into Ian. He then brought one big fist down on top of Vermin's head, stunning him. He shook the child off his leg, kicked the boy in the ribs as he staggered back, then turned and ran.
"Trudy! Trudy!"
Herman ran for her brother, who was lying in the leaf mould, mouth opening and closing like a landed trout. Ian hesitated, wanting to pursue Arch, worried that Vermin might be badly hurt, but Arch was already gone, vanished into the wood. Gritting his teeth, he crouched and passed his hands rapidly over Vermin. No blood, and the wain was getting back his breath now, gulping and wheezing like a leaky bellows.
"Trudy,"
Ian said to Herman, who was clinging tightly to Vermin's neck. Not waiting for an answer, he pulled up Vermin's ragged shirt, pulled out the waistband of his two big breeches, and peeked inside. He let go hastily. Herman leapt up, eyes bugged, and hands clasped protectively over her, yes, her, crotch.
"No," she said, "I won't let you stick your nasty prick in me."
"You couldn't pay me to,"
Ian assured her.
"If this is Trudy,"
he nodded at Vermin, who had rolled up onto her hands and knees, and was vomiting into the grass.
"What the devil's your name?"
"Hermione,"
the lass said sullen.
"She's Ermintrude."
Ian ran a hand over his face, trying to adjust to this information. Now that he looked,
Well, no. They still looked like filthy wee demons rather than little girls, their slitted eyes burning through the greasy, matted underbrush of their hair. They'd have to have their heads shaved, he supposed, and hoped he was nowhere in the neighbourhood when it was done. Aye, he said, for lack of anything sensible.
Well, then.
You've got gold,
said Ermyntrude, having stopped her retching. She sat up, wiped a small hand over her mouth, and spat expertly.
Where?
If I wouldn't tell him, why would I tell you? And you can just forget that notion right now,
he assured her, seeing her eyes dart to the knife in his belt.
Damn, what was he to do now?
He pushed away the shock of Archbug's appearance, time to think of that later, and ran a hand slowly through his hair, considering. The fact that they were girls didn't change anything, really. But the fact that they knew he had gold hidden did. He didn't dare leave them with anyone now, because if he did...
If you leave us, we'll tell about the gold, Hermione said promptly. We don't want to live in a stinky cabin. We want to go to London.
What? He stared at her, incredulous. What do you ken of London, for God's sake?
Our mam came from there.
Hermione said, and bit her lip to stop it trembling at mention of her mother. It was the first time she had spoken of her mother, Ian noted with interest, let alone display any sign of vulnerability.
She told us about it.
Mm-hmm. And why would I no just kill you myself?
He demanded, exasperated. To his astonishment, Hermann smiled at him, the first halfway pleasant expression he'd ever seen on her face.
The dog likes you, she said. He wouldn't like you if you killed people.
That's all you know, he muttered, and stood up.
Rollo, who'd been off about his own business, chose this opportune moment to saunter out of the underbrush, sniffing busily.
And where were you when I needed you?
Ian demanded. Rollo smelled carefully round the spot where Archbug had stood, then lifted his leg and urinated on a bush.
Would that bad old man have killed Hermie?
The little one asked suddenly as he boosted her onto the mule behind her sister.
No,
he said with certainty. But as he swung up into his own saddle, he wondered. He had the very uncomfortable feeling that Archbug understood the nature of guilt much too well. Enough to kill an innocent child only because her death would make Ian guilty for it. And Ian would. Arch knew that.
No, he repeated more strongly.
Archbug was both vengeful and vindictive, and had a right to be, he'd admit that. But Ian had nae grounds to think the man a monster. Still, he made the little girls ride in front of him until they made camp that night. There was no further sign of Archbug, though Ian felt now and then the crawling sensation of being watched when they camped. Was the man following him? Very likely he was, Ian thought, for surely it wasn't accident that had made him appear so suddenly. So, he'd gone back to the ruins of the big house then, thinking to retrieve the gold after Uncle Jamie had left, only to find it gone. He wondered briefly whether Arch had managed to kill the white sow, but dismissed that notion. His uncle said the creature was plainly from the infernal regions and thus indestructible, and he was himself inclined to believe it. He glanced at Rollo, who was dozing by his feet, but the dog gave no sign that anyone was near, though his ears were half-cocked. Ian relaxed a little, though he kept the knife on his person even while sleeping. Not entirely in respect of Archbug, marauders or wild beasts either. He looked across the fire to where Hermione and Trudy lay rolled up together in his blanket. Only they weren't. The blanket was cunningly wadded so as to appear to contain bodies, but a gust of wind had pulled a corner loose, and he could see that it lay flat. He closed his eyes in exasperation, then opened them and glanced down at the dog. Why did you no say something? He demanded. Surely you saw them leave.
We ain't gone,
said a gruff, small voice behind him, and he whirled to find the two of them crouched on either side of his open saddlebag, busily rifling it for food.
We's hungry,
said Trudy, matter-of-factly, stuffing the remains of a journey cake into her face.
I fed you.
He shot a few quail and baked them in mud. Granted, it wasn't a feast, but...
We're still hungry,
Hermione said with impeccable logic. She licked her fingers and burped.
Have you drunk all the beer?
He demanded, snatching up a stone bottle rolling near her feet.
Mm-hmm,
she said dreamily, and sat down quite suddenly.
You canna be thieving food,
he said severely, taking the depleted saddlebag from Trudy.
If you eat it all now, we'll be starving before I get you to... wherever we're going,
he ended rather weakly.
If we don't eat it, we'll starve now,
Trudy said logically.
Best starve later.
Where are we going?
Hermione was swaying gently to and fro like a small, filthy flower in the wind.
To Cross Creek, he said. It's the first good-sized town we'll come to, and I ken folk there.
Whether he knew anyone who might be of help in this present circumstance, too bad about his great-auntie Jocasta. Were she still at River Run, he could easily have left the girls there. But as it was, Jocasta and her husband Duncan had emigrated to Nova Scotia. There was Jocasta's body slave, Phaedra. He thought she was employed as a barmaid in Wilmington, but
no, she couldn't.
Is it as big as London?
Hermione collapsed gently onto her back and lay with her arms spread out. Rollo got up and came and sniffed her. She giggled, the first innocent sound he'd heard from her.
You all right, Hermie?
Trudy scampered over to her sister and squatted next to her in concern. Rollo, having smelled Hermione thoroughly, turned his attention to Trudy, who merely pushed aside his inquisitive nose. Hermione was now humming tunelessly to herself.
She's fine,
Ian said after a quick glance.
She's no but a bit drunk. It'll pass.
Oh.
Reassured, Trudy sat down next to her sister, hugging her knees.
Pap used to get drunk. He hollered and broke things, though.
Did he?
Uh-huh. He broke my mam's nose once.
Oh,
Ian said, having no idea how to answer this.
Too bad.
You think he's dead?
I hope so.
Me too,
she said, satisfied. She yawned hugely. He could smell her rotting teeth from where he sat, and then curled herself on the ground, cuddling close to Hermione. Sighing, Ian got up and fetched the blanket, and covered them both, tucking it gently around their small, limp bodies. Now what? He wondered. The recent exchange was the closest thing he'd had yet to an actual conversation with the girls, and he was under no illusions that their brief foray into amiability would last past daylight. Where would he find someone willing and able to deal with them? A tiny snore like the buzzing of a bee's wings came from the blanket, and he smiled involuntarily. Wee Mandy, Bree's daughter, had made a noise like that when she slept. He'd held Mandy, sleeping now and then, once for more than an hour, not wanting to surrender the tiny warm weight, watching the flicker of the pulse in her throat. Imagining, with longing and a pain tempered by distance, his own daughter. Stillborn, her face a mystery to him. Yexa, the Mohawk had called her. Little girl, too young to have a name. But she did have a name. Isabel. That's what he'd called her. He wrapped himself in the ragged plaid Uncle Jamie had given him when he'd chosen to be a Mohawk, and lay down by the fire. Pray. That's what his uncle, his parents, would have advised. He was unsure who to pray to, really, or what to say. Should he speak to Christ? Or his mother?
or perhaps one of the saints. The spirit of the red cedar that stood sentinel beyond the fire, or the life that moved in the wood, whispering on the night breeze.
"A year," he'd whispered at last to the open sky. "Kuditch me,"
and slept. Whether it was God or the night itself that answered him, at dawn, he woke with a notion. He'd been expecting the wall-eyed maid, but Mrs. Sylvie came to the door herself. She recalled him. He saw a flicker of recognition and, he thought, pleasure in her eyes, though it didn't go so far as a smile, of course.
"Mr. Murray," she said, cool and calm.
She looked down then and lost a trifle of her composure. She pushed the wire-rimmed spectacles up on her nose for a better look at what accompanied him, then raised her head and fixed him with suspicion.
"What's this?"
He'd been expecting this reaction and was ready for it. Without answering, he held up the fat wee pouch he'd made ready and shook it so she could hear the metal clink inside. Her face changed at that, and she stood back to let them in, though she went on looking wary. Not so wary as the little heathens, he still had trouble thinking of them as girls, who hung back until he took them each by a scrawny neck and propelled them firmly into Mrs. Sylvie's parlour. They sat under compulsion, but looked as though they had something in mind, and he kept a beady gaze on them, even as he talked with the proprietor of the establishment.
"Maids," she said, in open disbelief, looking at the girls.
He'd washed them in their clothes, forcibly, and had several bites to show for it, though luckily none had festered yet. But there had been nothing to do about their hair save chop it off, and he wasn't about to come near either one with a knife, for fear of injuring them or himself in the subsequent struggle. They sat and glared through the mats of their hair like gargoyles, red-eyed and malignant.
"Well, they dinna want to be whores," he said mildly, "and I dinna want them to be either. Not that I've any objection to the profession personally," he added for the sake of politeness.
A muscle twitched by her mouth, and she shot him a sharp glance, tinged with amusement through her spectacles.
"I'm glad to hear it," she said dryly,
and dropped her eyes to his feet, and raised them slowly, almost appraisingly, up the length of his body in a way that made him feel as though he'd been dipped in hot water. The eyes came to rest on his face again, and the look of amusement had intensified considerably. He coughed, recollecting, with a mixture of embarrassment and lust, a number of interesting images from their encounter more than 2 years before. Outwardly, she was a plain woman, past 30, her face and manner much more those of an autocratic nun than a whore. Beneath the unassuming calico gown and muslin apron, though, she gave fair value, did Mistress Sylvie.
"I'm no asking as a favour, eh?"
he said, and nodded at the pouch which he had put down on the table by his chair.
"I had it in mind to apprentice them, maybe."
"Apprentice girls? In a brothel?" She didn't make it a question, but her mouth twitched again.
"You could start them as maids. Surely you've cleaning to be done. Chamber pots to be emptied and the like. And then if they should be clever enough..."
He shot them a narrow glance of his own, and Hermione stuck out her tongue at him.
"You could maybe train them up to be cooks, or seamstresses. You must need a deal of mending down, aye? Torn sheets and the like?"
"Torn shifts, more like," she said, very dryly.
Her eyes flickered toward the ceiling, where a sound of rhythmic squeaking indicated the presence of a paying customer. The girls had sidled off their stools, and were prowling the parlour like wild cats, nosing things and bristling with caution. He realised suddenly that they'd never seen a town, let alone a civilised person's house. Mrs. Sylvie leaned forward and picked up the pouch, her eyes widening in surprise at the weight of it. She opened it and poured a handful of greasy black shot into her hand, glancing sharply up from it to him. He didn't speak, but smiled
and reaching forward, took one of the balls from the palm of her hand, dug his thumbnail hard into it, and dropped it back into her hand, the scored line glinting bright gold amid the darkness. She pursed her lips, weighing the bag again. All of it. It was, he'd estimated, more than 50 pounds worth of gold, half what he'd been carrying. He made a long reach and took a china ornament out of Hermione's hands.
It'll no be an easy job, he said. You'll earn it, I think.
I think so too, she said, watching Trudy, who, with extreme nonchalance, had lowered her breeches and was relieving herself in a corner of the hearth. The secret of their sex revealed, the girls had quite abandoned their requirements of privacy. Mrs. Sylvie rang her silver bell, and both girls turned toward the sound in surprise.
Why me? She asked. I couldn't think of anyone else who might be able to deal with them, Ian said simply. I'm very flattered.
You should be, he said, smiling.
Have we a bargain, then?
She drew a deep breath, eyeing the girls who had their heads together, whispering as they viewed her with the deepest suspicion. She let it out again, shaking her head.
I think it's likely a bad bargain, but times are hard.
What, in your business?
I should think the demand must be fairly constant.
He'd meant to joke, but she rounded on him, eyes narrowing.
Oh, the customers are ready enough to knock on my door no matter what, she said. But they've no money these days. No one does. I'll take a chicken or a flitch of bacon, but half of them haven't got so much as that. They'll pay with proclamation money or continentals or scrip from a militia unit. Want to guess how much any of those are worth in the market?
Aye.
But she was steaming like a kettle and turned on him, hissing.
Or they don't pay at all. When times are fair, so are men, mostly. But pinch them a bit and they stop seeing just why they need to pay for their pleasure. After all, what does it cost me? And I cannot refuse, or they will simply take what they want and then burn my house or hurt us for my temerity. You see that, I suppose.
The bitterness in her voice stung like a nettle, and he abruptly abandoned a half-formed impulse to propose that they seal their bargain in a personal way.
I see that, he replied, as evenly as he could. Is such a thing not always a risk of your profession, though? And you've prospered so far, eh?
Her mouth compressed for an instant.
I had a patron, a gentleman who offered me protection, in return for...
A hot flush rose in her thin cheeks.
None of your business, sir.
Is it not?
He nodded at the pouch in her hand.
If I'm placing my... these... well, them...
He gestured at the girls, now fingering the fabric of a curtain.
With you, surely I am entitled to ask whether I might be placing them in danger by doing so.
They're girls, she replied briefly. They were born in danger and will live their lives in that condition regardless of circumstance. But her hand had tightened on the pouch, knuckles white. He was that bit impressed that she was so honest, given that she plainly did need the money badly. In spite of her bitterness, though, he was rather enjoying the joust.
Do you think life's no dangerous for a man, then?
He asked, and without pausing, what happened to your pimp? The blood washed abruptly from her face, leaving it white as bleached bone. Her eyes flashed in it like sparks.
He was my brother, she said,
and her voice dropped to a furious whisper.
The Sons of Liberty tarred and feathered him, and left him on my doorstep to die. Now, sir, have you any further questions regarding my affairs, or is our business done?
Before he could make shift to find any response at all to this, the door opened, and a young woman came in. He felt a visceral shock at seeing her, and the edges of his vision went white. Then the room steadied round him, and he found he could draw breath again.
It wasn't Emily. The young woman, looking curiously from him to the little savages wrapped in the curtains, was part Indian, small and gracefully built, with Emily's long, thick, raven's wing hair flowing loose down her back, with Emily's broad cheekbones and delicate round chin. But she wasn't Emily. Thank God, he thought, but at the same time suffered a hollowness of the womb. He felt as though the sight of her had been a cannonball that had struck him, and having passed straight through his body, left a gaping hole in its wake. Mrs. Sylvie was giving the Indian girl brisk instructions, pointing at Hermione and Trudy. The girl's black brows rose briefly, but she nodded, and, smiling at the girls, invited them to accompany her to the kitchen for some food. The little girls promptly disentangled themselves from the curtains. It had been a long time since breakfast, and he'd had nothing for them then save a bit of drammach and some jerked bear meat, hard as shoe leather. They followed the Indian girl to the door of the room, sparing him not a glance. At the door, though, Hermione turned and, hitching up her baggy-seated breeches, fixed him with a glare and pointed a long, skinny finger of accusation at him.
"If we turns out to be whores after all, you fucker, I'm going to hunt you down, cut your balls off, and stuff 'em up your arse."
He took his leave with what dignity he could, the peals of Mrs. Sylvie's laughter ringing in his ears. Chapter 18. Pulling Teeth. New Bern, Colony of North Carolina, April 1777. I hated pulling teeth. The figure of speech that likens something of extreme difficulty to pulling teeth is not hyperbole. Even in the best of situations, a large person with a big mouth and a placid temperament, the affected tooth, one of those toward the front of the mouth and in the upper jaw, less in the way of roots and much easier of access, it was a messy, slippery, bone-crack business. And underlying the sheer physical unpleasantness of the job was usually an inescapable feeling of depression at the probable outcome. It was necessary. Beyond the pain of an abscessed tooth, a bad abscess could release bacteria into the bloodstream, causing septicemia and even death. But to remove a tooth, with no good means of replacing it, was to compromise not merely the patient's appearance, but also the function and structure of the mouth. A missing tooth allowed all those near it to shift out of place, altering the bite and making chewing much less efficient, which in turn affected the patient's nutrition, general health, and prospects for a long and happy life. Not, I reflected grimly, changing position yet again in hopes of gaining a view of the tooth I was after, that even the removal of several teeth would greatly damage the dentition of the poor little girl whose mouth I was working on. She couldn't be more than 8 or 9, with a narrow jaw and a pronounced overbite. Her canine baby teeth had not fallen out on time, and the permanent ones had come in behind them, giving her a sinister double-fanged appearance. This was aggravated by the unusual narrowness of her upper jaw, which had forced the two emergent front incisors to buckle inward, turning toward each other in such a way that the front surfaces of each tooth almost touched each other. I touched the abscessed upper molar, and she jerked against the straps that bound her to the chair, letting out a shriek that ran under my fingernails like a bamboo splinter. "Give her a bit more, please, Ian." I straightened up, feeling as though my lower back had been squeezed in a vice. I'd been working for several hours in the front room of Fergus's print shop and had a small bowl full of blood-stained teeth at my elbow and a rapt crowd outside the window to show for it. Ian made a dubious Scottish noise but picked up the bottle of whiskey and made an encouraging clucking noise toward the little girl, who screamed again at sight of his tattooed face and clamped her mouth shut. The girl's mother, out of patience, slapped her briskly, snatched the bottle from Ian's hand,
and inserting it into her daughter's mouth, upended it, pinching the girl's nose shut with the other hand. The child's eyes went round as pennies, and an explosion of whiskey droplets sprayed from the corners of her mouth, but her scrawny little neck bobbed convulsively as she swallowed, nonetheless. "I really think that's enough," I said, rather alarmed at the quantity of whiskey the child was swallowing. It was very bad whiskey, acquired locally, and while Jamie and Ian had both tasted it, and, after some discussion, decided that it probably wouldn't make anyone go blind, I had reservations about using it in any great amount. Said the mother, examining her daughter critically, but not removing the bottle.
"I'll do it, I suppose."
The child's eyes had rolled back in her head, and the straining little body suddenly relaxed, falling limp against the chair. The mother removed the whiskey bottle, wiped the mouth of it tidily on her apron, and handed it back to Ian with a nod. I hastily examined her pulse and breathing, but she seemed in reasonably good shape, so far at least.
"Carpe diem," I muttered, grabbing my tooth pliers. "Or perhaps I mean carpe venorum. Watch to see she keeps breathing, Ian."
Ian laughed and tilted the bottle, wetting a tiny swab of clean cloth with whiskey for the mopping up.
"I think you'll have time to take more than one tooth, Auntie, if you want. You could likely pull every tooth in the poor lassie's head and she wouldn't a twitch."
"It's a thought," I said, turning the child's head. "Can you bring the mirror, Ian?"
I had a tiny square of looking glass which could, with luck, be used to direct sunlight into a patient's mouth. And there was sunlight streaming through the window in abundance, warm and bright. Unfortunately, there were any number of curious heads pressed against the window, too, which kept moving into the path of the sun, frustrating Ian's attempts to beam sunlight where I needed it.
"Masali," I called, a thumb on the girl's pulse, just in case.
"Aye."
She came through from the back room where she'd been cleaning, or rather dirtying, type, wiping inky hands on a rag.
"Do you need Henri Christian again?"
"If you don't, or he doesn't mind."
"Not him," she assured me. "Likes nothing better, the wee praise hog. Johnny, Felicity, come fetch the wean, will you? He's wanted out front."
Felicity and Joan, a.k.a. the Hell Kittens, as Jamie called them, came eagerly. They enjoyed Henri Christian's performances nearly as much as he did.
"Come on, Bubbles," Joanie called, holding open the door to the kitchen.
Henri Christian came scampering out, rolling from side to side on short, bowed legs, ruddy face beaming.
"Oopala, oopala, oopala,"
he shouted, making for the door.
"Put his hat on him," Masali called. "The wind will get in his ears."
It was a bright day, but was windy, and Henri Christian had a tendency to ear infection. He had a woolen hat that tied under the chin, though, knitted in blue and white stripes, and decorated with a row of red bobbles. Brianna had made it for him, and the sight of it squeezed my heart a little, warmth and pain together. The girls each took him by a hand, Felicity stretching up at the last moment to grab an old slouch hat of her father's from the peg to put out for coins, and went out to cheers and whistles from the crowd. Through the window I could see Joanie clearing the books displayed on the table outside and Felicity hoisting Henri Christian up in their stead. He spread his stubby, powerful arms, beaming, and bowed in accomplished fashion to one side and the other. Then he bent, put his hands on the tabletop, and with a remarkable degree of controlled grace, stood on his head. I didn't wait to watch the rest of his show. It was mostly simple dancing and kicks, interspersed with somersaults and headstands, but made enchanting by his dwarfed stature and vivid personality. He had shifted the crowd away from the window momentarily, though, which was what I wanted. "Now, Ian," I said, and went back to work. With the flickering light from the mirror, it was a little easier to see what I was doing, and I got to grips with the tooth almost at once. This was the tricky part, though.
The tooth was badly cracked, and there was a good chance that it might fracture when I twisted it, rather than draw cleanly. And if that should happen... But it didn't. There was a small, muffled crack as the roots of the tooth parted from the jawbone, and I was holding the tiny white thing intact. The child's mother, who had been watching intently, sighed and relaxed a little. The little girl sighed too and settled in the chair. I checked again, but her pulse was fine, though her breathing was shallow. She'd likely sleep for...
A thought struck me. You know, I said to the mother, a little hesitantly, I could draw one or two more teeth without hurting her. See, I moved aside, motioning her to look. These, I touched the overdue baby canines, ought to be drawn at once to let the teeth behind take their places. And you see these front teeth, of course. Well, I've taken the upper bicuspid molar on the left. If I were to take the same tooth on the right, I think that perhaps her teeth would shift a bit to fill the empty space. And if you could persuade her to press with her tongue against those front teeth whenever she thought of it... It wasn't orthodontia by any means, and it did carry some increased risk of infection, but I was sorely tempted. The poor child looked like a cannibal bat. Said the mother, frowning into her daughter's mouth. How much will you give me for them?
How much? You want me to pay you?
They're fine sound teeth, the mother replied promptly. The tooth drawer down to the arbor'd give me a shilling apiece, and Glory'll need the money for her dowry.
Her dowry? I repeated, surprised.
The mother shrugged.
No one's likely to take the poor creature for her looks now, are they?
I was obliged to admit that this was likely true. Her deplorable dentition, quite aside, calling the child homely would be a compliment.
Masali, I called, have you got 4 shillings?
The gold in my hem swung heavily round my feet, but I couldn't make use of it in this situation. Masali turned round from the window where she'd been keeping an eye on Henri Christian and the girls, startled.
Not cash money, no.
That's all right, Auntie. Have some money.
Ian put down the mirror and dug in his sporran, emerging with a handful of coins.
Mind, he said, fixing the woman with a hard eye, you'd get no more nor 3 pence each for sound teeth, and likely no but a penny for a child's.
The woman, nothing daunted, looked down her nose at him.
There speaks a grasping Scotchman, she said, for all you're tattooed like a savage. 6 pence each, then, you penny-pinching miser.
Ian grinned at her, displaying his own fine teeth, which, if not entirely straight, were in excellent condition.
"Going to carry the wain down to the quay and let yon butcher rip her mouth to shreds?" he inquired pleasantly. "She'll be awake by then, Ken, and screaming." 3.
"Ian," I said.
"Well, I'm not going to let her cheat you, Auntie. Bad enough she's wanting you to draw the lassie's teeth for nothing, let alone pay for the honour."
Emboldened by my intervention, the woman stuck out her chin and repeated,
6 pence.
Masali, attracted by the altercation, came to peer into the girl's mouth.
"You'll not find that one a husband for less than 10 pound, she informed the woman bluntly. "Not looking like that. A man would be feared of being bitten when he kissed her.
Ian's right. In fact, you should be paying double for it."
"You agreed to pay when you came in, no?" Ian pressed. 2 pence to have the tooth drawn. And my aunt made you a bargain at that out of pity for the wain."
"Bloodsuckers," the woman explained. "It's true what they say. You Scots would take the pennies from a dead man's eyes."
Plainly, this wasn't going to be settled in a hurry. I could feel both Ian and Masali settling down to an enjoyable session of tag-team haggling. I sighed and took the mirror out of Ian's hand. I wouldn't need it for the canines, and perhaps by the time I got to the other bicuspid, he'd be paying attention again. In fact, the canines were simple, baby teeth, almost without roots and ready to fall. I could have tweaked them out with my fingers. One quick twist each, and they were out, the gums barely bleeding. Pleased, I dabbed the sights with a whiskey-soaked swab, then considered the bicuspid. It was on the other side of the mouth, which meant that by tilting the girl's head back, I could get a bit of light without using the mirror. I took Ian's hand, he was so engaged in argument that he barely noticed, and put it on the girl's head to hold it back and steady, then carefully insinuated my pliers. A shadow crossed my light, vanished, then came back, blocking it utterly. I turned in annoyance to find a rather elegant-looking gentleman peering through the window, a look of interest on his face. I scowled at him and motioned him aside. He blinked at me, but then nodded apology and stepped aside. Not waiting for any further interruption, I crouched,